I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
Hello and welcome to The Fear, a podcast about the overlap between comedy and horror. My name's Sarah Morgan. Hello. My guest this week is multi-hyphenate lady, writer, author... that's the same thing.
Idiot.
Right. Idiot. Musician. The fabulous Kate Hodges.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Yeah, very good.
So we are absolutely going to talk about you being an author because this episode of The Fear is a very special spooky books episode and you've written a book. And what's the book called?
It's called Welcome to the Dark Side, Occult London.
Fabulous.
It's so, a map. It's a map of London.
A map of London. So we're absolutely going to talk about it. But first, I would like you to tell the listeners at home who may not know the bands that you're in because they are very on brand for this podcast.
Oh, yeah,
You're in two bands.
Two fairly spooky bands.
I know about
bands.
Them. Yeah, yeah. You tell them about
one,
them.
One band is Ye Nuns, and that's an all-girl garage punk band. And we do covers of the Monks songs. The Monks were a 1960s garage punk band. A bunch of American GIs who lived in Germany, and we cover their songs. And the other band I'm in is the Hare and Hoof, which is kind of...
That's spelled H-A-R-E and H-O-O-F-E,
yes.
Hare and Hoof.
Yes, rather confusingly. And we are kind of, we're like a garage prog band. We sound like a 1960s garage band would sound if they had held it together until the early 1970s and discovered synthesizers.
And you draw very heavily on, I mean, I'm going to say sort of a Wicker Man, a cult.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of... I think we all grew up together. In fact, my brother is in the band. And so we all have... There's some common ground that we have. One of the major pieces of common ground is the Reader's Digest Guide to Folk Customs. And we basically have gone through that and episodes of Rent-A-Ghost and drawn those into our music.
Okay. If that doesn't excite you more than anything on earth, then you're listening to the wrong podcast. So I maybe drop a bit of Hare and Hoof. Or put some links, certainly, to... use guys'
Thanks.
Music
on the thing. You won't be disappointed.
Here today to talk about, well, we're here to talk about all kinds of spooky books because it's the run-up to Halloween, Goth Christmas. And
best time of the year.
Holidays are coming, holidays are coming. So we're talking about, I thought it would be a fun idea with, the Usborne, I'm going to say the Usborne Book of Ghosts. It's not actually called that. It's called The World of the Unknown Ghosts by Usborne has just been re-released. And then
very
you
exciting.
Also have your very exciting book coming out. So I thought I'd do an episode of the show where we just look each other square in the eye as old friends and go, holy fuck, do you remember this horror book? Wasn't that awesome? And we've both brought in giant stacks of literature, some matches, I'm very happy to say. We both brought in Supernatural Guide, Vampires, Werewolves and Demons, and Supernatural Guide's Mysterious Powers and Strange Forces, the little tiny black square books you can hold in your hand and you probably bought from a book fair when you were eight.
Did you buy it from a book fair? Yeah. I saved up my stamps and got these from the book fair.
Yeah. So, first of all, though, I would like you to tell me about Welcome to the Dark Side, Occult London.
Yeah, it's published by Herb Lester, who do the most beautiful annotated maps of London. They've done one on punk, and they've done some. They've done one for New York. They've done one of Bob Dylan's New York, which is really, really beautiful.
Where did the idea come from originally?
Well, actually, the idea came from a Herb Lester. Mm-hmm. So, which the mysterious Herb Lester came up with the idea and commissioned me to write the book.
But you've written lots of guides to various bits of London, which are all very useful if you are London-based, like rural London and London in lunch hour and stuff
And
that.
London for kids or for families, which is Little London. But this, this was a bit different. So I was on the search for occult London, which I kind of I defined as, it's not supernatural London, it's more people who are questing for esoteric knowledge. And it's not even... I covered Druids, I covered Aleister Crowley, I covered Austin Osman Spare, and I covered the Temple of Psychic Youth. Temple of Psychic Youth was Genesis P. Orridge and a few other musicians who kind of had this... they were in a band called Psychic TV, and they were artists, writers, free thinkers, and they sort of brought together music and art and paganism.
Cool.
And the Temple of Psychic Youth was their headquarters.
And whereabouts is that?
That's in Hackney. It was in Hackney. It got raided, and so they kind of they split for America.
So is the idea of the map that people will buy and they'll sort of go on these like pilgrimages to these like occult hotspots around London?
Yeah. And I mean, there's kind of been a lot written about, for example, Hawksmoor churches. You know, Hawksmoor was thought to have had a lot of occult influences in his architecture, and in the works of Alan Moore and graphic novelists, they kind of pull all that together, and I mean they've kind of given it more resonance.
What's your what was your favourite? Do you think do you have a favourite spot in London that's?
I really like I love Highgate Cemetery. Just because it feels like it's beautiful to walk in for a start, but also it feels like it's got this sense of history there, and also this sense of weirdness and brooding Victorian Gothic graves, and then of course there was the whole there was a vampire scare in the late 1960s, which was incredible, and it was just a story in itself. So there was the president of the British Psychic and Occult Society and the president of the British Occult Society, who are both performing kind of ceremonies alongside each other.
So Highgate Cemetery, it's like so many famous people are buried there. It's a really mad sort of carpet of like Karl Marx is there, and like Douglas Adams, and John Lydon, Jeremy Beadle.
all the
gamut of London based celebrity, and you have to pay to go in. It's like how popular it is. Like pay £4 to go and wander around it, and it's beautiful. But I did not realise there was someone actually. Were they killing people?
No, in the late 60s and 70s, there was this rash of sightings of a vampire, of a vampiric figure, and then these two magicians kind of went head to head trying to. Presidents of the Occult Society, trying to cleanse the cemetery of this vampire, and they were kind of locked in combat. It was really, it's a great story.
Let's say that someone only has a day in the Big Smoke. They're up for Extinction Rebellion. They've done their bit, and then they're going to go and.
Well, I'd trot off and trot through the security, brave the security, and get into the British Museum.
Oh yeah,
I think there's loads of things to look at in there. Lots and lots of kind of interesting occult stuff, but especially the John Doe stuff. John Doe was he was Queen Elizabeth's astrologer, and he was amazing. He had so much knowledge, and power as well. I mean, royalty would turn to him for advice, and he used to hang out at the palace. And if you go into the British Museum, you will see his obsidian mirror where he could. Sort of scry and look into the future.
What?
And it's there in a case. All of John Doe's possessions are there in the case. So I'd go there.
That sounds
and hang
awesome.
Out.
Yeah. Go and have an overpriced tea afterwards.
Yeah.
But you co-wrote this, right?
Yeah.
Who was your co-author?
My co-author was Tree, and she did a kind of more witchy stuff. She did. She's done some kind of spells and things that people can read and recite as I walk along.
Oh, fantastic. So, well, I mean, God, if anything needed some good psychic energy, it's London.
Yeah. yeah, there's a lot of, sort of bad psychic energy, bad juju around London at the moment. Yeah,
it's gone a little bit Ghostbusters too.
Yeah.
With the slight, I mean, you know, we started talking about this before we started recording, but, you know, I mean, at the moment, witches feel like might be the answer to everything.
I think they might be. And I think, well, in America, witches are trying to provide the answer to everything.
There's
a lot of witches on protests. There's a lot of witchy imagery.
Yeah, there's a fabulous Facebook group I'm part of called Bind Trump. And you know, I'm not a believer, but I'm glad these women are. Like, they stand outside Trump Tower doing binding spells, which what I love about that is that they, you know, Donald Trump has to pretend that he's religious, so that he has to pretend, like, he's... It was probably really unnerving if there's a bunch of very cool young women, possibly in black nail varnish, outside your house, binding, like, the tower card from a tower deck in black string and lighting stubby orange candles. Like, it's not subtle, but it's like, that's going to piss him off so much, and just chanting weird shit with this kind of feminine energy he will never understand. So in a way, it is working.
Well, it is working. I think if nothing else, it provides a really beautiful focus for protests. It's not only... It looks fantastic. So, you know, obviously, kind of post-protest, it's going to look striking. It's going to make the front pages. But also, it freaks people out.
Yeah.
And that's what protests are for. I went on an Extinction Rebellion march at the weekend, and it was all the more effective for being silent rather than shouting. So it was a funeral procession. And I think things like that unnerve rather than screaming people's faces are probably the most effective.
Well, we've strayed from creepy books, but let's pull ourselves back around to the subject because, yeah, the other one that came out this month that probably most listeners to this podcast are aware of, and if you're not, then God, go and buy one, The World of the Unknown Ghosts has been reissued. So the Usborne books, so Kate and I have just bought great big piles of our personal favourite spooky horror books that traumatised us into the women we are today. Is that fair to say?
It absolutely shaped me more than anything else, I think. More than music, more than films, more than anything was spooky books.
Yeah, and I think there's something about the Usbournes in particular. And when Joel Morris was on the show way back, I think it was like episode 2 or 3 or something, so a long time ago, but he's many of things. He's one of the owners of the Great Big Owl Network you're listening to this podcast on, but he's also a co-author of the Lady Bird books for grown-ups, and he made this really interesting point that one of the reasons why the Usbourne books were so horrifying is because they're presented to you in exactly the same way as all the other Usbourne books. So you'd have the Usbourne book of, like, helicopters dinosaurs. Yeah.
Yeah, it would be How Your Body Works, dinosaurs, ghosts alongside. So fact and more facts.
Exactly.
More ghost facts.
Just the fact that ghosts are a thing.
Yeah.
You 8-year-old child buying this from a book fair with your book tokens.
Yeah, and that was it. They were not only were they on the bookshelves, they were on bookshelves in schools and in libraries.
Yeah.
This is where I'd borrow them from the library. It was basically on constant loan to me.
Yeah.
The World of the Unknown Ghosts. And then I saved up my tokens, got the little mini versions from the school book.
I mean, this guy on the front, cover of Vampires, Werewolves and Demons. And yes, this is an interactive episode. You have to start Googling stuff along as we chat if you haven't got them in your own personal collection. The guy on the front of Vampires, Werewolves and Demons, I remember him so clearly. I think I fancied him, but
I fancied him too.
Way before Twilight or anything like that, you're just like, he had something going on. Because he's shy and the sun's coming up and he's melting a little bit. And this is the intro to Usbourne Book of Ghosts, not the Ruth Shearsmith intro that's been written. But what is a ghost? Ghosts are supposed to be the appearance of the spirits of the dead in a form visible to the living. According to those who have claimed to see ghosts, they usually look pale and cloudy. They can pass through solid objects such as doors and walls. They appear and vanish, leaving no trace. Whether they really do exist is still a complete mystery, but perhaps this book will help you make up your mind. And then it's just pages and pages and pages and pages of, yeah, this ghost actually happened. I think the most enduring image, I don't know, I mean, do you have any particular ones from Book of Ghosts?
From Book of Ghosts, I think I was always taken with the spooky skulls.
The skulls with fangs?
Yeah.
Oh, skulls with fangs.
Oh, the Spectres of the Brocken, because it's something really beautiful about this picture. It's a picture of the Harz Mountains in West Germany. And these enormous ghosts being projected onto the clouds behind. And actually here they explain, this is the section where they explain how some of the ghosts might have come about. This one was actually climbers, and this was their shadows being cast onto the clouds behind them. And that always really stayed with me, I think, that image. And this one,
you go through
like an old friend.
Yeah, this is an old friend, Black Shuck.
This is like if you're in a nightclub and they start playing Gold by Toto or something, you just go, Everyone runs to the dance floor. It's the Phantom Hound with one eye, one red eye. Hello, old friend.
An enormous beast the size of a calf. Its shaggy coat was as black as soot. And
one of the things that made Black Shuck different from other ghostly dogs was his single cyclops eye, as large as a saucer, in the centre of his forehead.
And I actually, even now, this is how much these books influenced me. When I was on holiday in Suffolk, I went and searched out the...
Did you?
Yeah, the church that Black Shuck clawed at. And you can go and see the claw marks in the door today.
Oh, my
Burn
God!
Burn marks on the door. So...
They're there? And are they
still there.
Are they still peddling Black Shuck
I think you have to kind of be a bit in the know. They really don't make a big deal about it in the church. You have to go and search it out.
That just confirms it's real. It's not like Nessie, where it's like full of, like, you know...
They're trying
Nessie
to...
bath bombs and stuff. This is like... Yeah, there's no Black Shuck tea towels because he's real.
He's real.
And the same page as Geff or Jeff. We're not sure. It's like a GIF situation with the talking mongoose.
Talking mongoose.
The talking mongoose, which should be as fucking ridiculous as a creature gets. And yet, when you look at the talking mongoose story, we are all slightly haunted by the idea.
Do you know what? This was actually a little bit of light relief for me.
Yeah.
For me, I would look at this picture of Black Shuck. Eek, Black Shuck. Oh, how can I make this go? I know. I'll read about the talking mongoose because he's a little bit cute but quite scary.
Nobody could make out exactly what Jeff was. He was not a poltergeist at work, nor did he seem to be a hallucination or a hoax. He simply claimed that he was a ghost in the form of a small mongoose.
Awesome.
There he is. And he was famous and featured in many newspapers.
I like the fact he didn't only speak, he told jokes and stories, swore and sang songs.
I mean, he sounds like a right laugh.
I want to meet him.
He sounds like a legend.
He does. Sounds like a total ledge. Let's get him down the pub.
Absolutely ledge. Oh, my God. So haunted houses. Then there's just various photos of churches. A bit boring. What else we got? Oh, yeah. Ghosts Around the World is always good because the artwork is just mad. Like, it's like sort of, you know, these are books that we looked at in Britain where you weren't really exposed to that much other culture from around the world, and looking at the Japanese legless ghost, you've never seen anything like it. It's like a woman on fire yanking her hair out with her legs on fire.
It's absolutely terrifying. It looks like
which
a
definitely
tattoo.
Happened. Oh, does it? Oh, that would make a boss tattoo.
It's a really cool tattoo. And the gibbering ghost, I remember, it just looks so different to everything else you've seen.
You know what's really lovely? One of the things about Osborne illustrations is that everyone look, all the ghosts and monsters and things look really chill a lot of the time. Like, they're really not sort of hysterical. They're all like...
It's because it's fact.
They're all quite relaxed. There's
Most
one
of the
in,
time they are chill.
They are. One of the ones in Vampires, Werewolves and Demons that I loved very much is Becoming a Werewolf. There's a chapter on Becoming a Werewolf. We're both looking at the same time. Some people were believed to turn into wolves during a full moon against their will. However, some bad people actually wanted to become ferocious werewolves, and they used magic to bring about the transformation. And then there's literally a step-by-step guide.
Here's how you become a werewolf.
Here is exactly...
First, take your cauldron.
Take a cauldron, and the guy looks a bit like Christa Berg. Oh, he... Yeah. Or a bit like Ian Beale having a nervous breakdown on any standards, and he's rubbing his chest... to turn into a werewolf. But then the werewolf at the end, he's quite chill.
Yeah, here I am. Look at me. Hey, guys.
Hey.
I did it.
And the same with the... There's something that's like mythical creatures from around the world or something. Who... where is it? Sorry. Wild werebeasts, which is the other kinds of beasts you can get that aren't just wolves. And they're shit. They're really shit monsters.
Oh, yeah. Here's a werefly.
There's a werecrocodile. The werecrocodile. I mean, that is actually nightmare fuel because...
Do you know, I'd like to meet him.
He looks...
I'd like to ride him.
Yeah. Oh, you're getting on his back.
Yeah. Riding around the jungle on a werecrocodile.
There's a snake. There's a really thick-looking lion. Who looks like... Oh, do you know what he looks like? Looks like that badly taxidermied lion that everyone shared a few years ago with the tongue hanging out like a big slab of beef.
Either that or Bill Beaumont, the rugby player.
Anyway, this is what haunted our dreams for most of our childhood.
It really did, and literally haunted. There are certain pictures that I look at now in haunted houses, ghosts and spectres. I think this was the one that really scared me. It's an Osborne book as well.
Yeah.
And there are certain pictures in here. Oh, I'm just looking through it. I'm a bit scared, or just even looking at it. There's one of Glam's Castle, pronounced Glam's. See, I pronounce it right because I can remember this.
Because you looked it up as a child.
It's pronounced Glam's. It tells me in Osborne, and I remembered it down the years. There was a phantom lady without a tongue, and this picture is just terrifying. There she is, coming towards the camera, her tongue ripped out, blood coming from her mouth.
She's a beautiful. What period of history are we talking here? It's she's wearing like a pilgrimy sort of.
Yeah, maybe like an Elizabethan dress or something.
Yeah, like a nice Laura Ashley kind of pastel pink dress. Yeah. But her tongue's been ripped out,
which
definitely happened and is a fact that you should remember alongside, how to pronounce pterodactyl.
The Walsingham ghosts, where. This is a house in America, which was haunted, and there's a picture in here that scared me so much. Looking at it now, I think it's just, is it Lon Chaney? So it's a blue floating head with blood pouring down from a cut on its head and terrifying teeth. And I was so scared of this picture that I would have to put this book outside my bedroom. It wasn't allowed in my bedroom after I'd finished reading it at night. I had to go and put it on a shelf somewhere else because having this book in the same room as me
too much power
scared me so much that I had to, it had to be somewhere else. And
how do you feel now holding it in your hands?
I'm actually shaking a bit. I am genuinely shaking.
This feels a bit S&M-y, like you're taking control of your fears.
I'm confronting something. But then I've kept this book since I was since I was 6 or 7. So I mean, it's obviously
your name's in the front, like Katie Hodges 2B.
There's certain pictures which scare me so much that they have just stayed with me.
This is the big one for me, definitely beyond. All the other things, page 29. It probably wasn't page 29 in the original. This is from the reissue of Ghosts, and it's the monk. And that's the thing. There's no information. I'd forgotten. I thought, when I read this, it will remind me where this altar is. There's no information. It just says, people commonly claim to see the ghosts of nuns and priests in churches. Often they're said to stand at or near the altar, praying. The photograph above of a cowled monk standing by an altar rail was taken in the early 1960s by the vicar of a church in England.
So vague.
Which vicar? What church? What?
Can we go and see it?
Yeah. Oh, imagine. It's like there's obviously some lovely double exposure. Something's happened, or it's a picture of a ghost. But it's just achieved with some sort of like white cloth over the face, dark eyes, and a cowled robe. And it's fucking. I'm now staring at it so hard. I feel like my hair's going to catch
fire.
So
scary. It's like a bit like the Elephant Man, and a bit like. A traditional ghost. It's just so.
Yeah, but it's
so
also
scary.
Like death as well. And death scared the shit out of me. The concept of death, the guy in the cowl as a figure. Because there was a book of poetry, and I don't know which one it was, but remember at school you had those collected books of poetry?
Yeah.
And there was, and they were always a bit rubbish. The Autumn Days and stuff. Bit of Spike Milligan, if you're lucky. But one of the poems was about something about death. But the picture was just the guy in the hood and the black, the empty hood. And it freaked the shit out of me. And I could never watch is it Airplane 1 or Airplane 2 that has the joke of, oh, it's fine, I think we might make it after all, and behind Jeff Stryker is actual death with the scythe and I would always have to freak out and like pause the video at that point because I couldn't
really
deal.
Really scary. I remember I had a set of Top Trump cards as well. Horror Top Trumps. Yeah. And death, of course, was...
The best one.
Yeah, was the one to have. But cowed death, even when I was playing Top Trumps.
What else is in the Top Trumps horror?
Thor. Weirdly.
Thor?
Thor, yeah.
That was wrong genre.
I know.
Have a word, tops.
Just like generic Fu Manchu, ghosts. Ghost was
just
one of them.
A ghost. I mean, you've really played your hand early there.
Frankenstein's monster. Yeah.
Frankenstein's monster. Yeah. He was quite a monster as well, though, if you think about it.
Frankenstein.
That's my hot take on that whole Frank.
Well done.
That's my hot take on that whole holiday. I think Mary Shelley.
It's taken 200 years.
Do you know what? So hot take. I think what Mary Shelley was saying, actually the monster wasn't...
I think you find Mary.
Didn't even have a name. Didn't even have a name, the monster. It wasn't called the monster. It was called nothing. It was nothing. The creature, I think it was called in the book. I haven't read Frankenstein.
It was a bit boring. I started to read it and it was a bit boring.
It's too many layers. Yeah. It's like a book in a book in a book in a book. And I feel like such a bad feminist for not having...
like a bad horror person.
Yeah, bad horror person and bad feminist. The two things I think I'm any good at. It's really hard going, though.
So stodgy. Yeah.
Do you know what I will read for hours, though, is any account of Mary Shelley writing Frankenstein.
Yeah, me too.
Which the more information that comes out about it is just like, this is the best story ever. Why am I not writing this film? It's like, everyone's like, oh, it was a lovely writer's retreat and her and Byron played a fun game of ghost stories. No, they were in a weird sex triangle with her stepsister and Shelley, Percy Shelley. He'd promised to pimp out his missus to Byron. Byron's doctor had also been promised. Like, it's a fucking sex farce that was going on.
What the hell?
She just had a miscarriage. No, she just had a baby and it died. She had another baby. She's 19. She's having an affair with Percy Shelley. He's still married. So she wasn't Mary Shelley then. She was Mary Wollstonecraft. Fuck, my God, is her name? What's her name? Wollstonecraft.
That's it.
Mary, yes, she was that. And she had an affair with Percy Shelley, who was a famous poet. She lost her virginity on her own mother's grave. So goth.
Oh God, who didn't?
And they ran away together with her stepsister. The papers referred to them as the incest gang. So clearly they were in some kind of like sexy, thruppily love triangle. And then they escaped the press and went and hung out with Byron, who was travelling incognito, also escaping the press because he was shagging his sister. And they... but he was in Switzerland, yeah. And they were, I love, this is like drunk history, but I'm not even drunk, I'm just a bit excited because I've just done all this reading on it. And it's like, and Byron's got like a monkey and like horses and cows and like there's peacocks with him. And he's travelling with his doctor and he's promised his doctor that the doctor can shag Mary Shelley and he's shagging the stepsister and it's this fuck cult.
Amazing.
It's fucking cool. And then they're all on laudanum and then there was a massive rainstorm because a volcano had gone off and everything was dark in Europe for a year. There was no sunshine. And then they all sat around and had one, and then were just like...
Well, the writing of Frankenstein just sounds quite tame after all of that.
Yeah, when you read it, it's like, oh yeah, she's very measured and prim and, but I'm going to cut this right down. But I am genuinely want to write a fucking film of it or something because everyone gets it wrong about the... Yeah. About that. They're all like, oh, and they sat around and told a delightful ghost story. It's like, no, she was so pissed off that the man she was having an affair with, Percy Shelley, and Byron were essentially sort of bromancing each other and trying to pimp her out to other people, that she sat down and wrote this book that was just like, ah, fucking men.
Wasn't there a film, though? Wasn't there...
There was a film, but it was all very crinolines and Pride and Prejudice, as they always do, because they think everyone in the past talked like Jane Austen
in the past.
But that was because no one swore and no one everyone wore crinolines and had tea at 4 o'clock, and it wasn't just posh people.
My mate bought a toaster. We go through celebrities' Amazon purchase histories so you don't have to. Keep calm and love Dom Jolly novelty keyring and fridge magnets.
Yeah, I love that.
The G-spot.
The good vibrations, guys.
Green dot laser sight rifle gun scope.
I've bought that quite a lot of times, I think.
Right, okay. The sex doctor's guide to keeping it hot.
Ah, interesting.
Did another child come along 9 months later?
Yeah.
Loads of great eps up now, and new ones dropping every Monday. That's My Mate Bought a Toaster from Great Big Al.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So neither of us have read Frankenstein, and we're bad feminists and bad horror women. But I do, apparently on the last page, he does just say, sorry, you can just call me Frankenstein, it's my name. Like my dad, my dad was...
Look, everybody's going to do it.
My dad
just call me Frankenstein.
Yeah, look, my dad was Frankenstein, so I'm Frankenstein. Or Frank-N-Stein, if you're doing the funny feet version.
Frankenstein.
Do you remember Funny Feet Yogurt?
Freaky
feet, not funny feet, freaky feet. Freaky Feet Yogurt. It was like monster yogurt that had... The freakiest thing about it was how much plastic it used. Like, you look at it now, you're like, oh, fucking hell, landfill, Extinction Rebellion. Greta Thunberg would start crying at them, but they are... They're like massive. They were massive 80s yogurts that were shaped like horror things. And there was one that was called Frankenstein.
Oh, I don't know how I missed that.
I mean, you know, were you even there in the 80s?
No,
anyway, I'm going to do it.
I want you
to
my bedroom reading my horror
you,
books.
I invite you and the... Well, speaking of horror books, I would invite you and the listener to close your eyes now. And tell me what this noise is. You're watching me.
I know what it is.
Without looking, what is that sound? Oh, it's so good. ASMR. What is that sound?
It's the giant thing from the inside of the Haunted House book.
It is the...
Bat!
Oh! It's the last page of Jan Pienowski's, which I think I'm pronouncing right, Haunted House book. And the last page... it was a pop-up book. It's fucking amazing. Every single page gives you kind of like nightmare flashbacks. Like, oh, this was... But the last page in particular has a bat. When you go up in the loft and you open it up and there's a bat flying and there's a saw poking out of a wooden box. And as you open and shut the page, the saw starts sawing its way out of the wooden box, and on the side of the box it just says, Transylvania.
It's beautiful.
Oh, it's what? So gorgeous. What a beautiful thing to own.
I
had to buy a new one a couple of years ago.
They're freaking expensive now.
They are, yeah. Apparently they reissued them last year. And just before they reissued them, I went on Abe Books and got one for like £7, which was actually really cheap because I think they were going for like £200 before that. But yeah, because obviously everyone's childhood version, you wrecked.
It fell apart. Well, even, I never owned a copy of Haunted House, but we had one. But we had one at our primary school, but they had to take it out of circulation because people kept pulling the spider off the stairs.
Yeah.
There's a little dangly spider.
Well, there's so many bits in it that, yeah, if you've got a copy where all the bits are intact, you open the first page, yeah, there's a beautiful spider dangling from a little thread, the cat's size move. There's so many bits for you and to spin and move around.
Classic things to pull, like the little pictures with eyes that go left and right when you pull the strip of paper across.
The fridge in the kitchen, you open it up and it's like this horrifying mass of spaghetti and some fried eggs and a sausage and an ice cream that are making a face.
It's so beautiful and so beautifully done. But yeah, we had to book time in to read Haunted House and then go and sit next to the teacher. Because people were pulling bits off it. It was
that popular.
Teacher
to sit and watch you?
Yeah, teacher was... You'd have to go and sit next to her.
I think this might be my favourite effect from it. There's one where you pull a tab and it's like a normal bed and you pull the tab and this ghost just appears over the top of the bed watching the person sleeping. It's so lovely. It is one of the most beautiful things. But yeah, again, I mean, I bought this for my kid and I'm slightly worried if I'm going to like traumatise her, but...
I think it's your duty to traumatise your kids slightly.
That's right. You're absolutely right, yeah.
They don't grow up with any kind of sense of danger or adventure or creativity. I think that's how you get your creativity. It's like in World of the Unknown Ghosts, at the back there was a guide to becoming a ghost hunter. And that's what I thought my job was going to be.
It seemed like a perfectly reasonable job, didn't it? Yeah. Again, it sort of set it up as if it was like how a combustion engine works, and some people become mechanics.
Yeah, and here's how to become a ghost. Here's how to become a ghost hunter, and I think that's all of mysterious powers and strange forces was another. We used to go through. My dad was a scientist. We used to go through this book and do all the experiments in it. We used to do ESP experiments.
Interesting.
We did dowsing. And it used to scare the hell out of me. And I know that my dad did kind of seances and
really?
hypnotising and things. But from a very scientific point of view, we made this little pyramid and we tried to sharpen razor blades underneath it, a cardboard pyramid. What, and of course, none of it worked. It was all disproved. But it was as much fun disproving it as it was.
But that's so lovely. That's genuinely, that's adorable. What sort of scientist was your dad?
He was a scientist. He was a doctor of chemistry.
And he knew you had these books and just went, let's go through and test whether ESP is real with wiggly stars and circles and
which
squares.
Is the best way to get a kid interested in science, was doing experiments, even if you knew what the result was going to be, to get do experiments to try and find out if ESP was real or not.
I have to say,
or if dowsing worked.
I always found Mysterious Powers and Strange Forces really boring, no offence if you worked on it, because it was all... But then, no one sat down with me and went, shall we do the can plants feel experiment, which is...
Yeah, let's get some other Shipton's Cave, which we did.
Yeah, the scare factor of a picture of a ficus with a couple of electrodes attached to it is not as, it's no Geff, the talking mongoose.
It's no Geff. And Indian rope tricks, trying to do the Indian rope tricks, I'll just tell you now, spoiler alert, it doesn't work.
Oh, that's a shame. That's a shame. Any other books that we've not covered that you bought in that you want to talk about?
Well, I really loved this part work, which was called The Unexplained.
Mm.
And The Unexplained, you used to go and buy it and newsagents and build up to an encyclopedia.
Holy shit, that's huge. Look at that.
I know. This is a compilation.
It's like an Argos. It looks exactly like an Argos catalogue.
It looks like an Argos catalogue of weirdness. And some
mystery.
Of the pictures in here just... Oh, this kind of really defined me. So there was a picture of spontaneous human combustion. A lady's leg sticking out next to
I remember that
fire.
Picture. I didn't see it in
the toilet.
Yes, of course.
Slightly weirdly. Yeah. And Enfield poltergeists, pictures of the Enfield poltergeists with the girls from Enfield just flying across the room, being flung across the room by mysterious powers. And another picture of, a real-life Yeti. The man-beast shot in Colombia and Venezuela is this massive monkey in a kind of mask thing. And these are the pictures.
He's quite striking, isn't he?
He is striking, isn't he?
Mm.
Yeah. So these are the kind of pictures that are indelible. They're burned on my brain. And
like they're spontaneously human combusted in your brain. Yeah.
The spontaneous human combustion burned into my brain. And I, even now, when I look at these pictures, they still make me, they still have this resonance and fascination. And in fact, I went on to work at Bizarre magazine, and basically,
of course you did.
We just my job there as features editor was just commissioning features, which were basically The Unexplained, but given a slightly sexier edge.
Yeah, I mean, I also wrote for Bizarre. I'm sure you commissioned me. It was anything that could be illustrated with a woman with pierced nipples and a rubber corset, as long as you can sort of find a pitch for that.
Sexy human combustion.
Sexy.
Here's half a woman in a bikini. The legs burned off.
Here's a foot for,
sexy foot though.
Sexy foot everyone. Fetish. Yeah.
Yeah. Sexy Yeti. In fact, I think we probably did do all of these, actually. Sexy.
Oh man, I love Bizarre. Bizarre was great.
An excellent place to work.
Cool. Oh yeah. I'm just flicking through if there's anything that we need, anything we haven't covered. Yeah, I mean, if you had to have sex with anyone from an Osborne, I think I probably... Oh, I quite like the bear from Befriending the Ghost of a Bear.
Oh, the bear.
Because he looks all right.
And a ghost is quite soft and harmless, isn't it? It's not like a werewolf.
I mean, Jeff would laugh you into bed. Jeff or Geff.
Jeff, he would be the one.
He's got some story. He sounds like a right laugh.
He is a right laugh. And not just between the sheets. He'll keep you entertained all day long with his stories and his jokes. And then you could disappear into the attic at night. Jeff, that's what it'd be.
All right, Jeff's your man. Yeah. All right. Before I started recording, I asked you to sort of send me some of your thoughts on what scares your child, and you were very immediate in saying Day of the Triffids.
Day of the Triffids was the most... Do you know, I worked out that I was... Day of the Triffids was a TV programme on BBC. It was shown in 1981, and it was an adaptation of a book by John Wyndham, and it was about the entire population of Earth looks to the sky, and there's a big meteor shower, comet shower, and they're all blinded, and there's societal breakdown, and this allows these giant plants, poisonous plants, to kind of, they make a break from an experimental laboratory and come out of the laboratory and kill people. They've got these great big sort of tongue-like proboscis things that come out and sting people. And they make a really terrifying sound as they walk down the street on their roots.
Yeah.
And hilarity ensues. And
well, yeah. Today when I went to go and have a look at the trailer, thinking, I wonder if it's still as scary as it was. And of course, the first thing you think when you see the plants is, no, it's not as scary. But the concept is still.
Concept is terrifying, and the theme song is more scary.
Yes. Well, I will drop that in right about now. The theme song is absolutely, yeah.
It's terrifying. So on the theme song, the credits were these kind of strangely lit people looking up into the sky, and it was illustrating the comet going over, and then the moment when they were going blind, and it was the start of the breakdown of society, and the cheery theme tune that soundtracked that was one of the most horrific things. I think I remember reading about it afterwards, and it was kind of done experimentally by Richard Rodney Bennett or somebody. And it's so scary. There's not a hint of jaunt or anything.
It's really chilling and really soulless. Would you like to watch the trailer with me?
Yeah.
For the Day of the Triffids, because it's really good. I was...
Starting on Wednesday on BBC One, The Day of the Triffids, a chilling serial based on John Wyndham's classic story. A global catastrophe threatens humanity with a deadly form of plant life.
If it were a choice of survival...
I quite fancy the scientist.
Blind man on a triffid? I know which I'd put my money on. But you're assuming equal intelligence.
It was very, very verbose and quite slow, Day of the Triffids.
Totally, but there they are.
There they are.
They look like sort of sticks of rhubarb and fannies. That's
it's kind of big, huge, thick lilies of the valley walking along.
Yeah.
And there he is.
There's a blind guy.
So he was like patient zero. He'd had an accident. The main guy had an accident, so he had his eyes bandaged up, so he didn't watch the comets. He didn't watch meteorites, so he could see afterwards. So he was one of the sighted people.
That's right. And I love this is some people recapping the plot for you in a pub. And a woman just fiddling with a box of matches while she's talking, which is maybe just don't have a fag in that scene. And there you go, that's the Triffids. Horrifying.
I watched it about 15 years ago, and it moves so... I think that was the really shocking thing. It moves so slowly. The whole of the first episode, it's just that guy waking up in hospital, recapping a bit, realising what had happened. And it ends, the whole episode ends with him taking off his bandages and getting out of the hospital.
So you don't see the Triffids.
It's so slow moving, and it's quite beautiful in a way. But that would all be done in 30 seconds.
Actually, you say that now we're in the golden age of television. Netflix would probably make a 20-part series of that. I bet you the first episode of Stranger Things has about as much plot.
That's true.
As that,
yeah.
I'm not going to get up on a Stranger Things chat. But so you saw this as a child?
I realised I worked out that I was eight. When I watched it, which it was extraordinary, because it's really, really, really scary. And it's not just scary because of Triffids. What was scary to me when I was a kid was watching the breakdown of society, because this was a time when Threads had been on and Where the Wind Blows was... I'd read Where the Wind Blows, and nuclear war was in the air and on the horizon and around the corner, and I was desperate to build a nuclear bunker in my back garden, and then to watch this programme, which basically was about what would happen if society broke down, like a nuclear winter, was really, really terrifying. And the Triffids were kind of just dressing on top, really. They were just kind of, they're almost there to jazz it up a bit. What the really scary bits were the woman scoffing, a blind woman eating detergent because she thought it was food.
Oh my God, that's
gangs of football supporters wandering around, kind of still chanting their football slogans but blind, and breaking into shops and cars just all driven off the road and driving really slowly. It was really terrifying. I think it's that whole thing. I think that's what fuels my fears now. That's what fuels my climate breakdown fears, is basically, I don't know if I had that tendency before I watched Day of the Triffids, or if it was Day of the Triffids that planted it in me.
But no pun intended. You looked so happy when you said sorry.
Planted. But I think it's that... That fear is, it kind of still drives me today. Mm. That fear of nuclear war.
Of course, it will have just
Triffids.
Yeah, I know exactly. Yes, it's the what is scary about the Triffids in hindsight is not plants that look like giant sticks of rhubarb with fanny bits hanging off them, you know, clitorises. I don't know. They're very sort of, stamens and all that.
It's kind of really quite sort of lavicious about it.
They're quite sexy plants, but they're, in a kind of biology class way, like stamens and pollens and stuff like that, they look like that. But that isn't the scary thing about the Day of the Triffids. It's how fast society will.
Yeah. And the fact that society, and in Day of the Triffids, they all kind of split into factions as well. Mm. So there's this man who says, no, what we need to do is you all need to take care of 10 blind people, and you all need to be in charge of them, and we need to split everybody up. And then there's this other guy who just comes around in a tank and tries to shoot everybody. And it's all these kind of different solutions to this awful, awful thing that's happened in society, and the violence and the... It's really nihilistic and scary. Even the end of it, spoiler alert, even the end of it is pretty fudged and not very upbeat at all.
Amazing. So we've covered, you know, so much of what freaked you out as a kid, and you know, these brilliant scary books and the scary TV show. But was there anything else that really unnerved you as a child? Any irrational fears?
Yeah, I was really obsessed with getting the plague, and whether I had the plague, and the plague in general. And I would read obsessively about the symptoms, and then check myself for those symptoms. So every night I'd check under my arms to see if I had a bubo, which is a lump, and a bubo. And I'd look for mottled skin patches, and I was so, and take my temperature, I was so obsessed with the fact that I may have the plague. I think that stemmed from watching a TV programme called The Bells of Astercoat, which is about a plague village, and visiting a plague village in Derbyshire, I think it's in Derbyshire, called Eam, and they'd isolated themselves off when they realised that they'd had a load of infected clothes sent in. And so this plague village just isolated, and they all, most of them died from the plague, but they protected the surrounding villages from its spreading. And I was always really, really kind of choked up by that and amazed at their bravery, but also totally freaked out. Like, how would you feel if you were living in that plague village and you'd been told to kind of stay put and basically just get the plague and die to save for the greater good?
It was always a big thing in school, wasn't it? You know, you did World War II and you did the plague. Because you had the plague and the Fire of London right next to each other, so they were very good at telling you a certain amount about history.
Yeah. And also I liked the fact that as far as school was concerned, that once you had the Fire of London, it's and it cleansed London of the plague, and that's the end of the plague horrors. But, you know, it obviously the plague lingered on in other places in the world. And I would often I remember looking at atlases and things are trying to work out whether the plague was still around and what parts of the world it was around in.
Oh my God, making sure you never went there.
Yeah, making sure that's on my list.
Not letting rats crawl on your face.
Yeah. And I think that's what kind of really stemmed my fear of rats as well. Yeah. So now I used to go to, you know, museums and things, and there'd be reconstructions, there'd be rats scuttling around or whatever. And so even now when I hear the scuttle of a rat or I see a rat, the first thing I think is plague. I'm going to get the plague.
Oh my God.
Runs up my trouser leg, which it obviously looks like it's going to.
And was there any reassuring you that you couldn't possibly get the plague?
No, not really. No, no, not at all. In fact, my mum and dad were obviously very sensible people. But they couldn't.
It's a lot to expect. Yeah, if your kid is like, Mum, I've got this medieval illness.
Yeah. What's the potential for me getting this medieval illness?
Put some bread on it, or those. Oh. Everything about the plague was so creepy and memorable. Like, you get those the outfits that they had to wear to like go from door to door.
Yes.
The birdmen masks, the great big bird masks.
The plague doctors with their great big birdmen masks, and then yeah, people, and they put the white cross on the door if you had plague. It was all really
ring of roses, yeah. Which may or may not be. I mean, one, you know, I really have to look like on Snopes at some point because I'm not entirely certain if ring of roses was about the plague or not.
I say
about
it was because it's fun.
It's cool.
It's fun to think, and that's a cool thing. But yeah, there's so much kind of iconography associated. Mm. You don't get that kind of thing associated with measles or whatever. Measles has no
anti-vax
gothic glamour at all. Plague is all like long robes, ringing bells to say that you're unclean. Well, that's leprosy, but. And just it just has the glamour, and it's like almost as soon as you get the plague, you have to dress in these raggedy old black robes. And
I mean, there's so much iconography, and it's very sexy.
It's very sexy. Does it apart from the buboes and the pus and the sweats? I mean, it's quite a sexy disease.
Well, those plague doctor outfits. If you go on eBay, and God knows, I don't know why I know this.
I know this because I've gone looking for plague doctor outfits on eBay.
But you know, this is quite a big part of fetish culture, as you probably know from working on Bizarre magazine being a pervert. I don't know, but
I'm not a pervert, but just interested in perversity.
You're pervert adjacent, like myself.
I
just like to have a look at things. Yeah, yeah. I'm fascinated by what other people are fascinated by.
I love to watch, and it's leather plague doctor masks.
Yeah, they go for thousands. People recreate these sexy plague doctor masks, and because the whole point of these masks that look like sort of horrifying birds is that in the beak. They were meant to have herbs which they believed stopped you getting the plague. They were full of sort of lavender and spices and lemon and weird shit. So they must have smelled very nice, but they look absolutely terrifying.
Really
but
scary.
But then anything that's scary, someone turns into a sexy thing, don't they? So you go on eBay. I'm going to just see if I can find one on eBay.
You can get cheap and nasty versions.
Oh, yeah. I bet Smithies do. Leg Avenue. Sexy plague doctor.
It wouldn't be called a plague doctor. It would be called illness physician.
Pointy face illness physician. I'm just going to see if I can find one on eBay. Plague doctor, and then I'm going to go sort price from low to high to low. The most expensive plague doctor. There you go. So yeah, there's 120. That's actually I've seen more expensive than that. Steampunk plague doctor mask, one with gold rivets, white PVC.
I'd go for a gold one. Add a little glamour.
It's a bit. It's very. Oh, look at that one.
A few sequins, maybe a tassel.
I think we can. And so, remind the listeners, what's your fantastic book called?
It's called Welcome to the Dark Side, Occult London, and Herb Lester are publishing it on the 31st of October.
So, any more favourite places from this Occult London map?
I really like the London Stone, which is... It's in a little case near Cannon Street Station. Mm-hmm. It's a lump of rock, and you go and it has such a brilliant, and people seem to just imprint history onto this little piece of rock. It's really, really interesting. William Blake thought it was a druid's altar, where they'd make human sacrifices on it. Other people thought that it was the stone which Excalibur was drawn from by Arthur, and it's. Other people say that London will fall if it's moved from the boundaries, and somebody else said that Jack Cade, who was like this rebel, said that he used it as a throne as well. And
I love the idea that there's this sort of lump of rock in the middle of London, and everyone's imprinted their own idea of what it does onto it.
Yeah, so everybody's imprinted their own kind of, everybody has their own take on it. Mm. So, and Shakespeare wrote about it. And in Peter Ackroyd's book about John Dee, he's obsessed with it as well. Mm. And so it has all these kind of different meanings, but all of them are kind of weird and occult and esoteric. Yeah. It's just this piece of stone that... I mean, and it ended up being... embedded into the front of a WH Smith for years and years and years. And a sports shop, before that was a sports shop, WH Smith. It's just really kind of low rent for years and years. But now they've kind of redeveloped and it's in this, the wall of this kind of redevelopment, and it's a lot kind of swisher. But I mean, I kind of liked it when it was in.
Oh, I love that. You're on a pilgrimage to WH Smith and going, because presumably, if you are in any way a believer in kind of like vibes and energies, that thing is fucking thrumming with.
Absolutely.
With like juju, whatever you want to call it. It's probably got something like crackles with like whatever vibes you want to pretend.
Yeah, and then there it is just by the post-its and amateur photographer. Yeah. And it's a bit of grubby old carpet. Is there? I mean, it's jazzed up now in this development. But it's just a really, really brilliant kind of cipher and a kind of icon for London history as well.
It's a great metaphor for London, actually. Yes, it is what you make of it.
It is. Yeah, London, you bring your own thing to the
You absolutely
to
bring your own thing to the table. That's really cool.
Yeah.
So, yes, listeners should definitely get hold of a copy of that. And
it's at all good bookshops.
All good bookshops.
All good map shops.
Big up to Anna from Usborne, from the World of the Unknown, who was responsible for reissuing the Usborne Book of Ghosts this year.
Yeah, well done, Usborne, for doing that.
Done, Anna. Just a shout out to you, because you've been lovely. We've been talking loads about doing something about this book, and I'm so glad we did, because it's been... I hope all the listeners at home have got their own copies out and are doing a little read-along. It's been horrifying. Kate Hodges, thank you so much for joining me on The Fear.
Thanks, Sarah Morgan.
Bye!
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.